You are listening to the Green Lantern Corecast, episode number 33. This episode, Xenophobia.
To the Green Lantern Corecast. I'm your host, Frankie Mateo, and joining me today are Kuhan, an admirer of Japanese culture, Colton, and also admirer of Japanese pornography, Eric, not an admirer of either of those, you know, kinds.
That's racist.
That's true. You dislike most things of a different culture.
No, Brandon's a racist.
Brandon.
100% not true.
That's not racist.
Brandon, who can't tell Chinese from Japanese.
Brandon believes things aren't racist and things are just being overblown. And we are your Green Lantern Corecast today. Today we're going to be discussing a few bits of news about the Green Lantern movie. Two of previous issues of Green Lantern. Well, two are brand new. And talking about the Green Lantern Rise of the Manhunter game with all the little knickknacks and things that you might not have known about it, or things that you might have known about it, or things that you might not have even cared for. But we're going to bring them to you all in this segment of the Green Lantern Corecast. In today's news, it has been unconfirmed that the Warner Brothers are launching a sequel to the Green Lantern movie. Now, we haven't got a positive yes, we haven't got a positive no, but we have a unconfirmed rumor that it is in the works, and it actually is in talks that it's still going to be happening. Now, this is sort of, you know, out of left field, mainly for the fact that right during the course of the Green Lantern movie, before it came out, it was already confirmed that the second movie was greenlit. But now, after the movie itself has already launched, it's sort of in muddy waters.
And made $12.
Yeah, we're not sure as to what's the... what is the future, what the future holds for the Green Lantern movie, number two. What are your thoughts on this, my illustrious crew?
Well, I think it's kind of standard procedure for them to announce a sequel, to really suggest they're making a sequel, even if it doesn't do well. And a matter of fact, a lot of movies like this that you see a big fallout about it being not a great success, you see a lot of studios kind of hinting out there that they're going to make a sequel, and I think some of it's about drumming up business. I mean, we saw it after Hulk with Eric Bana, which actually did make a lot of money. We saw it after Superman Returns. We saw it after Incredible Hulk. I mean,
Avatar. Airbender, rather.
Oh, Airbender. Yeah, you got a lot of the movies are not making that much money, and all of a sudden they're like, "Yeah, we got a real good sequel coming out. It's going to be really good." And the idea being that they saw that there was an interest there, but people didn't like the movie. So that they're like, well, you liked it, you sort of liked it, right? Like, there's going to be more, maybe. And invariably, these don't work out. It's really just studios damage control. I mean, it's very possible we are going to see a Green Lantern sequel, because the scuttlebutt around the announcements was that Warner Brothers is really interested in creating a new franchise, because they're losing the Harry Potter franchise, obviously. And they don't have anything kind of lying around, and DC characters are the easiest bet. But that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to get a Green Lantern sequel. It does mean we're probably going to get another DC superhero movie, but I don't know. I think this is dubious at best. And I think the fact that Warner Brothers then immediately said we're not sure, it's kind of like they're not going to admit that it's a failure. They're not going to be like, shit, that bombed. Oh, well. They're going to say at least neutral things about it, and so they don't look like assholes until it's time for it to go out on DVD, you know?
Well, I think they're still trying to make that decision. I mean, because, I mean, you can look around at other studios going through the same situation with Disney and Tron, or Disney with Cars going
or to Disney
decide.
With...
Yeah, Disney.
Disney insert some sort of failed project here.
If you look at, what was it? Cars, like I just said, Disney and Pixar's Cars, it was like when the first Cars launched, it was like, okay, this is decent, but it's not up to Pixar's standard. Then they said, fuck it, we're going to make a sequel anyway.
Well, it's not a weird movie like Cars.
Well, that's
because
that's
it made money.
Technically, not even that. Cars is a bad example because Cars is and this is, I don't know if people realize this. Cars is, if not the, it's one of the.
It is the.
No, it is the. Cars makes up $1 billion. Yeah, yeah.
A billion, yeah,
exactly. For in merchandising, and that's what it's mostly. I assume a NASCAR thing. But while the movie was a hit, it wasn't a massive hit, and it was the most successful merchandising, which technically makes it the most successful Disney movie ever made. So, I mean, it's a little different with Green Lantern. We're going to see those toys that I was looking so hard to find last month for 12 cents on a shelf in another month. So,
well, yeah, they're still launching so many Green Lantern merchandises things that haven't come out yet, and I think once they see the dollar start raking in from the theme park, from the games, from the animated series coming out, and all these other licenses, then they'll say, okay, well, we're making this much off the name alone. That's enough to greenlight this sequel, which is only going to boost those up even further. And I think if that. What's his name? Michael Goldenberg, who rewrote the sequel script. Yeah, if he hacked out anything that's decent,
all these stuff and the fact that, I mean, this movie itself cost a lot of money, but that was a lot of hand wringing and back and forth and stuff like that, and you didn't really see the money on the screen. That movie didn't really look like a $200 million movie, you know?
No, it did not.
It should have looked better.
So, I mean, bigger in terms of, like, I like to see Sinestro Corps and, like, actual flying around and more than one or two Green Lanterns on the screen at a time, et cetera, et cetera. So.
the funny thing I will mention about that, but you know what? I digress. I'll bring that up during my review of the Green Lantern movie, which had not been put with the rest of the cast of the last session. But we'll get to that later. Moving into, we're going to actually discuss the Green Lantern Rise of the Manhunters video game. Eric and Brandon, you both had like hands-on experience with this game. Tell me a little bit about how this game changed your lives for the better.
Make me want it or make me hate it.
Yeah, I don't know who else. I played it all the way through as soon as it came out. I don't know who else. Brandon, you just said you just tried it out or something?
Yeah, I didn't. I got maybe 2-3 hours with it.
Yeah, so you almost finished it, right?
Yeah, the game itself
only took about maybe 8 hours to complete, and that's not even true. I think I had it. And I think in between phone calls to Frankie that weekend, I finished it. Which maybe I called Frankie a lot that weekend, maybe I didn't. But at point in fact, it doesn't matter. I beat it in less than 4 days, so it was really short. It actually was kind of fun. I mean, it reminded me a lot of God of War, I guess. But every action game since God of War reminds me of God of War, and it reminded me of the Wolverine game for X-Men Origins Wolverine, which is really good praise because that's one of the best. It doesn't really matter what shape they're in, you know. Like if Guy Gardner makes a pair of double Ds, you know, and Hal Jordan makes a boxing glove, it hits the guy the same way. It's not like the double Ds will be bouncier, but that's whatever. Basically, the game covers. I guess it should have been a sequel to the movie. I played it before I saw the movie, and then if you follow the story, it shows how Hal learns about the yellow energy, and you go down to the yellow energy battery and stuff. And I mean, it's kind of like an in-between Cool, I guess, because it throws the whole after-credit sequence out of whack because the second player is Sinestro, and that's kind of cool. Except Sinestro doesn't get his own constructs. It's pretty much the same exact thing as playing as Hal, except you're playing with Sinestro model. I guess for me, the coolest thing about the game was that you get to go around fighting Green Lantern villains, but mostly you just fight Manhunters for like 600,000 levels, and that's really obnoxious after a while. You fight some... Zamorons for a while, but even then it's kind of like they Manhunter show up to help them, and then they explode when they die too, so you're like what am I doing? But I guess the best part of the game is that Kyle Rayner villain, spoiler, is the main villain of the game. Amon Sur is the main villain of the game, and at the end you fight him with a big yellow spear, and very little to do with actual Amon Sur, but you know, overall, again, not a great game experience. There's no flying in the game. It's basically just like a beat-em-up. It's short enough that it didn't bother me that it was so kind of derivative. And otherwise, I don't know how much to say about it. It wasn't worth the price I paid for it. I paid new game price for it. So you guys want to wait a couple of weeks and download it off of PlayStation Network or something, that'd be pretty cool. But otherwise, no extra features to speak of. I think a lot of my love for Green Lantern got me through it. It's fun to play a game where you play as Green Lantern and you really do feel like Green Lantern, except that you can't fly or do anything Green Lantern does. So just kidding. I mean, I actually don't have a lot of negative things to say about it. It's easy to please me with, I don't know if I told you guys, I'm kind of like a merchandising hoe for like movies and stuff. Like I buy all the prequel comics and I buy a lot of the toys and stuff because I get really into it. And so the fact that the game existed and had a vaguely Ryan Reynolds looking figure doing vaguely Green Lantern is totally enough for me. So, but overall, you can't give it more than, you really can. And I would love to. You can't give it more than 5 out of 10. And that's on my really harsh scale of I want to give everything a 0. So.
Seems really harsh.
It was just
Ryan,
it doesn't
you
give
rebuttal?
You, yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say it be eventually. Yeah, and, you know, they all looked kind of cool. Sinestro and his swords were nice. I'm not a fan of the button smash and beat 'em up games like this is, but, I thought it worked well. Not much to say after Eric, but, I think I'd give it a little more than 5 out of 10. That seems kind of harsh for, you know, cause my standards weren't high for this game. So you have to take that into equation. I guess I'd give it like a 7 out of 10, just average. I think let's make a 6 because of the replay value.
Can you just like yeah, five I mean, is harsh and then give it a 6?
Yeah, there's a big difference between 5 and 6.
I'm not gonna play a game DS. That looks like I'm not gonna play it what the Wii is, which is a big DS. I'm not gonna play that for $60. But
or a 3DS version, which
well,
is
no,
cheaper.
I think it's $50 on Wii,
and oh, probably $35 or $30 on a
$10 3DS. Is not. I think the downgrade from the way the Wii looks from where my PlayStation is $10 to me. But you know, maybe when the Wii goes under, I'll get a couple of Wii games,
which shouldn't be too far away.
Yeah.
When the Wii U comes out, that's when the Wii will go down.
Yeah, they've got like
either way,
2 more months of producing games for that thing.
I know. I played in PlayStation 3. Apparently on Xbox, there was a limited time offer to get an alternate version of the suit that they quickly took off. And now that the game is, obviously the movie is tanked, there's really no reason to pour extra money into downloadable features.
There definitely won't be any DLC for this.
This is kind of it. I mean, it's cool. Again, it's cool. First ever Green Lantern 100% video game for a legitimate console. And that's cool. There are Green Lantern references in it. It's written, I think, by Marv Wolfman, I believe, is the one who, quote unquote, wrote it. You know, and there's good stuff to see, but otherwise, it's not as exciting as Make Whatever You Want. And it'd be nice if there was a game with that depth where you can have a beat 'em up type game like this or a space adventure type game with the kind of Scribblenauts thing. But I don't really mind. Like I said, you're really not going to have too much variety in terms of what they do. I mean, the visuals are exciting in and of themselves, and the game is short enough that by the time the game is over, you have just about enough to get every construct. And so you could play it through again with the constructs if you want, but I did not really notice the fact that there wasn't a lot of variety, considering, again, a hammer does a hammer, a sword does a sword, and a gun does a gun. It doesn't really matter if it's a laser or a rocket or if it's a scimitar or a katana, so...
I'd say it would matter if it was a rocket versus just a sword.
Well, not
in the game.
Not in the game.
Well, you could design a game that could do that.
But again, I mean, it'd be nice, but I'm just... The point I'm trying to say is that the constructs stand in for weapon. You know, it's a melee weapon. Doesn't matter if it's a baseball.
Yeah,
I mean, obviously...
That's pretty much how you explain it. I think, not to go on forever here, but like, if you look at Super Smash Brothers, the difference in weapons there is drastically different from... the sword and the baseball bat here, you know, it's drastically different. A Pokeball does some damage, and you know, just throwing an item doesn't do as much damage in Super Smash Brothers. But the sword here and the boxing glove here is the exact same.
Yeah.
Huh.
So overall, I mean, like I said, fun to play. Worth it if you're a Green Lantern fan. Otherwise, not really much. It's a pass.
I highly recommend to put $60 on it. But if you do actually want to play a full Green Lantern game, go ahead, rent it, see what you think, buy it if you want, or buy it in the bargain bin. Moving on, we're going to be discussing the Green Lantern movie tie-in comic books, the precursors to the movie, the Avenger story, Hal Jordan story. Starting off with the Avenger story, we get a little sneak as to Avenger's character prior to the events of the movie, and a little glimpse as to Amanda Waller's character, who was somewhat featured in the movie, I guess. Somewhat featured in the movie. And apparently Avenger's disdain for the Earth Sector. Quite weird.
Well, not the Earth Sector, just the planet.
Yeah, it's a planet within the sector. I just want to say.
He's
2814.
I mean, he controlled the sector.
I just want to say Earth sector. Is that so wrong?
Actually, it is. Especially since
it's numerically set 2814.
You know what? We're not going to get into an argument about that. All right, both of you. Enough.
Yes, sir.
Quiet corner.
Anyway, my biggest problem with this prequel comic is that Abin Sur was such a scumbag that there was a human being who was in legitimate peril, and he just watches them in increasing peril, wondering if they're going to die. And then when they live, saying to himself, I guess humans are worth not being shit upon by gorillas after all. Like, literally, this character, Amanda Waller, does everything she possibly can to excel in life, and this guy says, just enough for me not to hate you. I mean, and, you know, again, does the exact opposite of a Green Lantern, just sits there and watches that shit happen. You know?
I mean, what would have happened if she'd have died? Would he have been like, Earth's not worth anything?
I mean, exactly.
He probably would have said that. He probably would have. Exactly.
And then when he arrives on Earth, he's like, Ring, go as far from this planet as possible when you find someone.
Yeah.
And then he would just give a big middle finger as the ring flies off and then dies.
With my last breath, I curse you, Earth.
Yeah, and for some reason, I feel like cursing Hal Jordan.
And the fact that the art is so uneven, I mean, you know, he looks totally disgusting. I mean, it's cool that Patrick Gleason got to draw some of it because everybody knows I love Patrick Gleason. But and it really does play up the fact that his makeup looks like Freddy Krueger and is therefore completely disgusting. But you know, overall, it's kind of like whatevs. And I think this you know, this is going to seem like kind of nitpicking, but the whole thing where he stops a smuggler in the beginning. But he's never been to Earth. Why is he so interested in a smuggler just because they're an alien versus, like, the smugglers on Earth? I mean, why doesn't he bother to fight crime on Earth? I mean, in the movie, it makes it seem like the ring only alerts Hal Jordan to danger when there's, like, cosmic-level danger. You know, otherwise he can just kind of play with himself and make necklaces for his lady friend, you know? And otherwise, this is kind of like, you know, you can fight crime, just don't fight crime here. And why would they pick a xenophobic guy to be Green Lantern in the first place? I mean, I guess the movie kind of is vague about what makes people Green Lanterns, because the movie makes it pretty clear that even the other Green Lanterns didn't know why Green Lanterns were being picked, because they spend the whole movie telling Hal, you got to be fearless, whereas Carol Ferris is like, no, you have to overcome fear, and it's like,
oh my God,
the other Green Lantern was like, oh, I guess so too. I don't know. Sure, why not? You
know? Yeah, apparently, while you're supposed to be fearless, there isn't a clause about being a dick.
Yeah, and so, I mean, exactly, and it's kind of like, xenophobic. He's like, I'm not going to Earth. That's dirty. And it's like, that's insane. It's like, and it's almost
it's
like
your job, you asshole.
There's a certain amount of logic to it. It's like the Star Trek Prime Directive thing where he's like, well, they're pre-warp or whatever, so I can't get down there. But that's not directly stated enough for me. And again, there's plenty. I can think of people that I know that have suffered horrendously that a big ugly dude with a giant green magic ring would have been able to help them out. But he's like, fuck that noise. You're stupid. You know, and even then, Amanda Waller does this amazing thing, and presumably 10 years later, Abin Sur had yet to return to Earth again. So, what are you going to do?
The weirdest concept of that entire story was so be that the Abin Sur is forced begrudgingly to go to Earth because of a problem he caused.
Yeah, he caused it.
He caused the problem itself.
Yeah.
such a weird scenario. It's like, I stopped this one smuggler, I accidentally forget to clean up. The piece that, you know, the most dangerous piece goes out to Europe, and he's like, do I have to really clean the rest of this up? It's like, yeah, it's your job to do it. Like, ah, fuck this planet.
Yeah, and this is...
I like Mars better.
This is definitely exemplary of these prequel comics, and unfortunately why most prequel comics are terrible, you know? I mean, I'm trying to think of movie prequel comics that I thought were really good, and I guess, I hate to say it, but like the X-Men movie prequel comics, because each one was a little... In hindsight, they don't fit with the continuity of the movies, you know, but it was comics that were written as one-shot standalone adventures featuring character situations in the movies that kind of spun off into their own little storylines that made sense, whereas in these are just kind of designed to buffer personalities of people that don't really have personalities in the first place, you know, and the buffer isn't really very shiny. It's kind of like they're using a dirty rag to clean a table, you know. I mean, there's not really anything – you're not going to see a shine on this, you know, and especially considering this is supposed to be Abin Sur's highlight, and all we found out is that he's a racist who has really high standards, you know, and then Amanda Waller, I guess what we learned about her is that she's tough. You know, so I don't know. And why would they have an extra normal alien organization, you know, 40 years ago if they didn't know that there was aliens at all, you know? But whatever. Is then
why not? Why not? Anyone else wants to chime in on Brandon?
I think there's, like Eric said, you finding out Amanda Waller is tough. I think we should highlight on that. That Amanda Waller was done pretty well here. It's not
our Amanda Waller from the regular DC universe.
But, it's not even the movie's Amanda Waller.
Amanda Waller's tough like Hulk Hogan strong.
This young woman who happens to be named Amanda Waller is pretty well written here. She has a nice little life, and though her circle of military whatever she's under here, I don't know. Is she Marines here or whatever?
I think she's Rangers. Ranger? Oh, I could be.
Yeah, okay, sure. Whatever affiliation she is with, apparently they're just as.
Honestly, the main story of this was not interesting. I don't really care about watching Amanda Waller fight a robotic tank. It's stupid. It's a waste of 16 pages, and it's a waste of my time.
Mechasaur.
Yeah, can't call it a waste of 16 pages. I mean, it's only a waste because we expected more Abensur, but.
It's not even just doesn't add anything. It doesn't add anything.
Let's move on to another issue that we expected more Hal Jordan in, but got none.
Hal Jordan?
Yes, the other prequel. The other movie prequel that came out, which came out only a couple of days ago. Right after the movie, the Green Lantern movie prequel, Hal Jordan, which features not one, not two, but three Green Lanterns in this one. So we get Sinestro, we get Tomar Ray, and the discussion between why Hal Jordan should actually be a Green Lantern or why he's not. You know, it's a big head scratcher.
So it's not a prequel at all, much as the midquel.
It comes off as a little bit creepy that they're just staring at him in his underwear while he's sleeping.
It's they have a really simplistic conversation where nothing of merit is actually said. So that conversation is – I mean, I want to – let me just say the art because I'm probably going to rip on this pretty hard. But the art is pretty amazing. Jerry Orbe seems to have some trouble with proportions for Tomar Ray. And that's fine. He's got a very specific style that's not suited to it. But Jerry Orbe, I think, is an amazing artist, and I think he murders it in this. But the characters have a completely stupid conversation that's completely meaningless, you know, because basically Sinestro just says a bunch of things like humans are awful and they're selfish and they're stupid. And no one else in the universe is like that. And yet, like, I don't see anything that indicates any of the other Green Lantern characters aren't the exact same characters. I mean,
it actually explains a lot of how Abensur acted. That's where Sinestro got it from.
Well, I mean, I think the idea that all the Green Lanterns hate humans, and this is something that the obviously the movie wants to play up in these prequel comics.
The race is so primitive that it's not even got space travel, yet they're universally hated by aliens.
I mean, you know, and then what's the deal?
Do they have a TV channel called Earth? And they're like, oh, look at these people.
And it's like
sitting around watching this primitive race trying to crawl. They go, look at these dumb fucks.
I love reality television.
Yeah, he's like, they're still warring amongst each other. It's like, so we're supposed to believe that not a single other race in the universe is at war. And the fact that, like, they're like, oh, they're so self-consumed and so racist. And I think – I mean, obviously, I guess it's supposed to be irony, but it's laid out a little thick, you know, because Sinestro is a character saying, I'm so great because these guys are so shitty because they think they're so great. It's like, all right, I get it. That's supposed to be irony. But the fact that it goes on for – I don't know. This actually isn't 20 pages. This is about 14 pages. it's just abominable. And most of this just recaps the movie. You know, it adds one scene or maybe a scene and a half, which is the potential – what would have been potential John Stewart cameo, which I guess is Hal Jordan punching out his superior because he's straight up going to rape a lady in the middle of a crowd. And I was going to say there was a thing even where Tomer's like, we're going to see some more humans, and Sinestro's like, no. And it's almost like they were like, haha, we might even see Kyle. No, I'm not going to see Kyle. And I'm like, why not show Kyle? Why not just draw a little Milo Ventimiglia face and shows me Kyle? But again, I don't really – again, they have a completely superfluous conversation. And the fact, let's see where his fear was born. And it's like, I don't know why they keep – equating every single – and it's Jeff Johns, you know, equating every – because he's just trying to beat home that the Green Lantern mythos is about this and overcoming fear. And not a single story he's ever written has ever been about overcoming fear, despite the fact characters keep saying it. It's not about overcoming fear. I mean, you know, the first time in Secret Origin Hal beats Yellow is because he gets angry. You know, it's not about overcoming fear. And this
– He overcame fear with rage.
And it's like – and not even in the movie. He doesn't overcome fear by overcoming fear. He just – you know, someone says you can overcome fear, and he does. That's it. I mean, it's not like he does anything to overcome fear. He's a pretty fearless dude. The only time he's scared of anything is when Sinestro beats him up and then puts a sword in his face, and that's it. You know, I mean, the rest of the time he's kind of
gone. That's a reasonable time to fear, too.
You know, yeah. I mean, it's a momentary knee-jerk reaction. I mean, you know. But
that's what keeps you alive is fear.
So the fact that they say, let's see, when, so they try to base every single problem Hal has on the fact that his dad died in front of him and stuff. And I don't, you know, I don't really understand what do we even, I don't know. Again, I don't see what this is saying. This is a lot of gibberish. It's practically New Age gibberish, which makes it even more unforgivable to me, you know, so I don't know. I can't see, besides the art, which is fantastic. I can't imagine anybody enjoyed this.
I just realized that the only way you can overcome fear is if someone tells you to overcome fear, then you'll instantly overcome it.
Yeah. What was he even afraid of? I don't understand. In the movie, it's like, my dad died, so I'm afraid of being responsible. Which, but I don't understand. You've done everything your dad did. You joined the Air Force like your dad. You fly planes like your dad. And you get death-defying escapes like your dad. What does that even have to do with anything? I mean,
maybe he's not afraid he's going to die like his dad.
What does even makes him irresponsible? Because as soon as he's given the ring, he's like, cool, I want to fight crime. And then he just doesn't really like himself. I mean, for me, it's low self-esteem. That's not about fear. I mean, I guess it's you're shameful. I mean, well, why did you have
fear of failure?
But what does he mean, fear of failure? Because he doesn't seem to – there's no point – there's only one point in the movie where he's like, I can't do this. I'm done, which is when the Green Lanterns give him the ring. And he's like eventually he's like, yeah, Sinestro beat me up pretty good and gave me a really big talking down to. He's probably right. But then he kept the ring, you know?
Because, well, it's – okay. I don't want to harp back on the movie, right. So I'll make this quick.
Yeah, I'll let you get to that point. I'll let you get to that point.
Yeah. Let's move on.
What did anybody else think about the issue? I'm sure somebody's got something nice to say about it.
I can't really say anything real nice about the issue. The issue itself was pretty much derivative of just the fact that Sinestro was saying these guys are afraid.
Abster told me when training that these guys suck, so they suck.
Man, these guys, it's a weird, it's just a weird put together story of just which Eric, you brought it back before, it seems like to be a deleted scene from the movie. It looks like this could be part of the in-between scene when Hal goes to Oa and then Hal leaves and wakes up. It's just that point in the story where we're supposed to now get an understanding of Sinestro's character, now get an understanding of Tomar's character as being the one who is more accepting of Hal Jordan, even though, you know, he knows nothing about him, while Sinestro's, you know, more of the naysayer, not wanting anything to do with this character. But there's no real rhyme or reason as to why either of them really have a, you know, an opinion of the character. I mean, yes, Otomar sees a few things here and there that show that paint a picture of who Hal Jordan is, but Sinestro's unbridling hatred for the character is just weird. There's nothing behind it.
I mean, I don't understand what the logic is, because the logic is Sinestro is so insanely devoted to the core in this continuity, you know, and yet the ring chooses him, and he's like, this is impossible, I can't choose him. It's like, who are you to even fucking judge? Like, that's ridiculous. And Tomar just takes the general track, which is like, well, the ring chose him, so it's like the boss has hired him. We can't just stand around the water cooler saying he's such shit before he even starts, I mean, because we're racist. Like, that's insane. Why don't they take his fucking ring away for being such an asshole?
So it's a weird story. Anyway, to move on, Colin, what do you have to say for this issue?
Generally, I actually agree. I mean, nothing happens except for a couple flashbacks, and then Sinestro's like, what happened? Sarah told me they suck. They suck. You need to fire him. He doesn't deserve it.
All right. So the sad bit about this issue itself, with the movie prequel, aside from the fact that it actually came out a week after the movie itself came out, there is about a five-page story.
Monstrously awful short story.
A short story at the end of the Hal Jordan segment, which shows a newly recruited female Green Lantern chosen for random reasons and then told that she was meant for the job. Why? I have no idea why it was there at all.
And why did they keep this randomly saying Emerald Warrior?
Yeah, it's a weird concept.
They wanted to bring home the themes, quote-unquote. Well, first of all, it's horrendous looking. A complete waste of time. Doesn't make any sense. No lessons are learned. And every line of dialogue is completely incongruous to the one right before it. So,
well, what if this character matters? The question.
At one point, she hits a ship with her back. And she says, that ship hit a building and it's plummeting because of me. So this is like a child writing it. And the ship did not hit a building. There is no building being hit. You hit the ship and it is crashing. I guess that's a ship. Then she saves the ship and she's like, it's my fault. I shouldn't be Green Lantern. And then the guy basically says, well, I didn't hire you. So go to the green light and you'll find out that you should have the green light. And then she shows up and just waves the green light around and then it's over. It's incredibly stupid.
It's pretty funny because it's not a point where Estelle, which is the guy that she saves, doesn't say, like, you know, I didn't hire you. It's more like, oh my God, I'm sorry. I totally crashed your car by accident. Are you okay? He's like, ah, don't worry about it. It's fine. Let's go over here. You're the new cap in the force after you destroyed my Jag. It's cool. It's a weirdly put story.
It's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. 100% complete garbage.
Anyway, moving off of the back, let's move on to an alternate world with an alternate Hal Jordan. Flashpoint, Hal Jordan number one of the three-part series in the Flashpoint continuity, where he never got the ring. And of course, as true Hal Jordan fashion, he's still high-flying, still apparently screwing up his life, and his dad's still dead.
Still completely boring.
This is like exactly what I expected it to be.
A complete waste of time.
Just him sans ring? That's what you're saying?
Well, no, it's the same thing. Yes, exact same life, except at the end he gets the ring.
Yeah. We don't know yet, but
he's, come on.
Even if he doesn't, that's not the point. The point is that the only thing that wouldn't make him get the ring at this point is Evan Sir doesn't die, and that's the only difference. And it looks like nothing at all is different about his life. You know, I mean, and if anything, and which even more frustrating is they spend the first 20 pages recapping his life exactly. I mean, it's like there's no variation.
He even shows the one punch, like when he punches the superior. The difference is that
Hal Jordan is destined to do everything over and over again in Jeff Johns' continuity.
Hal is destined to be bland.
There is the one notable difference is that instead of, you know, only being a test pilot and then being kicked off for, you know, he can't fly in the air anymore, now he has to fly because there's a war with Aquaman, whatever.
Even then, it seems like he's still flying for Ferris Air. They're just helping patrol, and that's really it. There's no difference. He's just given a slightly different...
Please tell me we're going to see Hal Jordan fly a plane at Aquaman.
I mean, the problem is this is a very continuity-heavy crossover. I mean, you're required to know a significant amount of continuity to even make sense of it. There's not a single storyline or miniseries or one-shot that hasn't been introduced that isn't 150% rely upon your understanding of really, really, really intricate and complex and 75-year continuity.
I think part of it, enjoying the book relies on you having continuity. But
well, I'm saying I think it's required to understand what's happening. The problem with this storyline is that it comes in the middle and I guess for some reason assumes for the first 20 pages of it that no one who's ever read it has read a Green Lantern comic before.
Right.
We should say, like, oh, that's good. It means they're getting new readers, but it's contingent on the fact that he used to be Green Lantern, contingent on the fact that Green Lantern fans are reading it. I mean, they know there's going to be a lot of diminishing returns on this. Anybody who's buying the crossover is going to buy it, but presumably it's like they're recapping information that could have been recapped in, you know, a page and a half, 2 pages. You don't need to reiterate the punch. The punch doesn't add anything to this. You know, you don't need to reiterate another scene of him and his dad. You don't need to reiterate him getting the jacket again. I mean,
or his failed relationship with Carol Ferris.
I mean, that's one thing you could always say, the relationship's going to change by the end of it, and that's what the Flashpoint difference is. But I mean, it's completely. I mean, again,
well, if you were a new reader, would you want all that summed up and not fleshed out?
I mean, again, I understand the idea of it being like we're trying to approach a new reader here, you know. But again, it's kind of like this storyline is not designed for that, and a new reader isn't going to pick up something that says Hal Jordan. I mean, it's kind of
yes, they are.
Not really. I'm sorry. The
Flashpoint Hal Jordan. That's maybe the least attractive title of anything.
the fact that the story again, Flashpoint itself is reliant on not so much on new readers, but on readers that already have been reading these DC comics for the last, I don't know, 4 years, 4 to 5 years. New readers can jump on this event storyline, but and be introduced during the regular title, like Flashpoint. Other little comics like Hal Jordan, The Outsider, Wonder Woman and the Furies, those are stories that should, by themselves, be reliant on their own continuity, on within themselves.
Well, you could say that one possible new group is the people who just saw the Green Lantern movie and said, like, I want to read a comic about Hal Jordan or Green Lantern.
Which is fine, but then they're reading about an alternate continuity, which is completely superfluous in 2 issues, you know? So the reading of this is only contingent on wanting to read every Green Lantern comic like we do, or wanting to read everything that's happened in the Flashpoint world, which you already have to have a certain knowledge of to make sense of either way. Another thing is, if this isn't relying on continuity, why do we have a character, which we all just argued about, Shark, show up? The Shark who's at the very least, an obscure villain for Green Lantern, who is a man who is a man-shark that has psychic powers that can do anything with matter and reality and stuff. And, like, the fact that a shark man jumps on his plane and starts thinking into his head all this harsh stuff, I mean, any audience member who doesn't recognize the character is completely in the dark. You know, they're like, what the fuck is happening here?
You know, a giant shark.
A giant shark with psychic powers.
Just jumped out the water.
Oh, yeah. God, it's a street surfing shark.
Okay, that itself can be passed upon because just again, it's a three-part story. Technically, we don't need to learn anything else about it except for what's going on within its own borders. The only thing I really liked about the issue was the recap of Hal Jordan's life. Technically, I didn't really need to see that again. No real reader or newcomer to the story should be introduced to that story again because, again, this is an alternate reality. If your new reader jumps onto this story seeing that it's the exact same continuity prior to this, then they're going to go like, so what was the difference?
And I get the argument, and I get the idea being like, well, if you're a brand new reader moving on to this, you want to give them a certain amount of newer information. But this isn't exactly who this is being targeted for. Even if it was, it's still reliant. The end is still reliant on knowledge of what happens with him and Ambedkar in proper continuity. And the fact of the matter is, it's reliant upon a knowledge of that Hal Jordan was Green Lantern. And if you have any knowledge, if you have any interest in Hal Jordan coming out of the movie or any interest in Green Lantern coming into the comics and stuff, you kind of already know a certain amount of stuff. And again, the comic is assuming you know a certain amount of stuff, you know, about these characters. It's kind of like my problem with the Ambedkar, you know, those slightly twists on it. I said my problem with the Ambedkar one shot was that I was kind of reliant on your knowledge of a fictional Ambedkar that never existed, based on another fictional Ambedkar that was never written in comics that has just been kind of implied in Geoff Johns' recent history. So we're supposed to be shocked and awed that Ambedkar is such a different character, but we've never fully known Ambedkar whatsoever besides what Geoff Johns and Sinestro has told us offhandedly. Whereas in this is, again, we know everything about Hal Jordan. Nothing is different at all except that Aquaman attacked and he has to fight King Shark. And can I just say, if there is a dude that is on your jet, just fly faster or fly higher. Why do you need to crash a jet into another jet to get him off? Just fly faster or fly higher. I don't understand why they do that.
I forget. Apparently there was a lot of dialogue where Carol's like, I can't do it, Hal. And he's like, well, I got to dram my jet into your jet to win this thing.
Why? And then, even then it's like, and he uses his psychic powers he's got psychic powers, and the shark, you know, for anybody who's interested, has reality altering powers, can do almost anything. And obviously he was dumbed down in the Geoff Johns comics just to be a big shark guy and stuff, but he uses his psychic powers here for like two panels, and then the next couple panels just spends time trying to eat them. Isn't it more effective if you're trying to take out jets when you're just a shark dude to use your reality altering psychic powers to take them out? I mean, this is just bad writing 101.
According to Geoff Johns, he doesn't even need shark powers to beat Green Lantern. All he has to do is bite his battery and then it explodes.
Well, the weirdest part about that entire thing was that he uses his telepathic powers only to read his mind to go, now I know what you're afraid of. And then he goes after Carol Ferris. I'm like, wait, you did what?
And here's the worst thing about it, right? Because then Hector is like, no, Hal, don't smash those two planes together. I spent painstaking hours perfecting this equipment. It's like, first off, those are jets. You didn't build those from scratch. They're multi-million-dollar jets, and you're.
Anybody else have an opinion on this issue?
I love that Hal seems to be contractually obligated, or maybe he made a deal with the devil or something. But every time he's on a plane, he has to land it by crashing it into something else.
And he didn't crash this one, the last one at the end.
Yeah.
which I love that he I think it was Hector's like, you know, like, you can't take that plane, and he's like, I'm going to take it. It's like, well, you know, there's more than just taking a plane. You need clearance to take off. You need, like, there's a lot of things that go into taking a plane out.
Hal Jordan doesn't need your shit.
Remember, in this weird continuity of time-traveling mishaps, you don't need any of those things in proper clearance. You just need suspension of disbelief. If you have a plane, you have a pilot, they're gone. You know what I mean?
It's not as if, you know, there was a giant roadblock or he had walked back into the building and then came out. He was just, you know, there's a plane right there, so I'm going to hop in it.
But Adam Flagman does not need a strip, some sort of dude with waving some, you know, yellow and
some clipboard. Lights,
a clipboard, some sort of flight manifest. He doesn't need nothing. Nothing.
Well, especially in wartime, where you're prone to crash into Amazons, it's not a good idea. Just take a plane.
Let's discuss the brilliance of taking off without air clearance in the middle of a war.
Yeah, exactly.
I think on that note, we should mention that Adam Schlagman is an editor first. Like, 95% of the writers for these Flashpoint tie-ins are.
Peter Tomasi was an editor.
Peter Tomasi was an editor for several years, and so was Tony Bedard, but being an editor doesn't mean you're going to be a great writer.
Yeah, but then they shouldn't be writing comics.
Right, exactly.
Well, like I just said, 95%
I'm an editor first and foremost.
Calm down.
It's like saying, you know, first and foremost, he's not an actor, but, you know, like, in this, I thought he was pretty good.
It's like whenever you see, like, it's like Rosie something, there is terrible, but it's okay. She's not an actress. It's like, she shouldn't have been in the movie doing any acting.
Okay,
like, I understand.
95%, okay, first of all, 95%, like I just said, 95% of the writers on these Flashpoint tie-ins are editors, are former editors. Let's make that clear. Former editors, most of them are former editors of DC Comics. So
most of them are jobless.
If you look at this, obviously this was a contractual obligation that DC had to fulfill to give these writers, I mean, these editors something to do before they were
kicked to the curb. Wait, are you serious? You're telling me this is that the main reason why most of these writers, and again, this is just on your basis, it's not been confirmed, this hasn't been said by DC's main office or anything like that, but you're telling me that these writers, these former editors and writers, are writing a major event storyline because they were contractually obligated to just write a storyline.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that could be true, but I think you do see this a lot with crossovers this big. They plan to do these giant crossovers with all these different tie-ins, and then they realize they really don't have the talent to stretch it across, so they take people that are kind of already on hand and make them write stuff. I mean,
part of that is probably contract issues, and part of that is saving talent for this reboot that comes directly after.
I mean, how hard could it be to write three issues? And they have most of the people working on the reboot stuff for the Flashpoint anyway. Just that they have like something like 35 new titles or 50 new titles for Flashpoint.
And it's 3 months though. I think that's what it is. It's 3 months, and that's 3 months. That's the lead time that most artists get for a new series is three months.
Yes, I think what it is it demonstrates is that DC has no real interest in the quality of the story. And that's all it is. I mean, they know they're hiring guys as even West is saying, I mean, more excusing, but saying, you know, the idea is that these guys aren't really the best writers. Even if they're just editors, it's like, well, their writing is not their strongest suit. They're only writers because they used to be editors, and they might or might not just be kind of fulfilling a need. But I think basically that's exactly what it is. I think you have editors come in and do pitch writing when they have to because they have to. It's kind of like, you know, if you're the only guy at work that day, they make you do the stuff that needs to get done, you know?
Exactly.
And that's basically what it is, and I think I don't want that to excuse the bad writing, because it's basically what we're saying is that DC admitted that they knew they were putting writers that weren't good enough onto projects that we all thought were going to be bad in the first place, and that's kind of like that's so systemic and endemic, and that's just terrible. You know, I mean, it's terrible to say like we know going into it's going to be terrible, and we know that this is proven because the people on it are terrible, and they were chosen by the higher ups because they were terrible, and they don't care. I mean, that's insane.
Right, right. Adam is still very much involved in DC. He's at mm-hmm. DC Entertainment right now. Brian Nazarello is writing Batman, and
Sterling Gates is a writer, and that was no good. Kid Flash is no good.
Jeff Johns is a writer, and that's
okay. On that note, I think we should move on.
We're going to move on now to a non-alternate timeline-ish issue, I guess.
But still out of place.
But still out of place in the current Green Lantern storyline. Green Lantern Emerald Warriors number 11, all featuring Guy Gardner and his amazing talent. We were supposed to see a confrontation between Krona, the Guardians with all their high and mighty, you know, entity powers, and the last remaining, you know, members of the Corps fighting, you know, all out battle to, you know, dictate the future of the entire, you know, all existence or whatever. And we saw about, you know, Guy Gardner making out with some grotesque shapeshifter.
I think I don't really mind that it broke away from I wanted to see a War of the Green Lanterns ended, and I guess it kind of surprised me by how frustrated I was that I didn't get to see the ending. I guess I was interested to see how it ends, so that's good for the title, I guess. Bad for my moral well-being, but good for the title. But I think this has what we've all kind of said we've wanted for a while, which is a storyline that doesn't tie into a lot of crossovers and stuff. Though, again, it is primarily Green Lantern motivated, as in internal, as in the character was only attacked because he's a Green Lantern. And the next storyline that's a self-contained storyline is about two Green Lanterns that are murdered, so it's still keeping it all within the – it's like watching a cop show about cops that only solve mysteries involving cops, so that's kind of frustrating. But besides that, I mean, we're getting what we want. I just happen to think this is kind of – not to say obviously, but this looks like it was kind of thrown together at the last minute. Bernard Chang is kind of – a super duper fill in artist, you know, and Peter Tomasi is not doing anything terribly amazing here. But this is actually a really depressing story, because the whole story is about essentially a guy who's trapped on a ship who goes along with this plan to murder a Green Lantern, and then saves his life, and then is left to die, and then is stabbed to death.
While he was not left to die. He just happened to die.
He just happened to be dead.
It's not as if he could have followed Guy through that hallway and survived.
Well, I don't understand why the person that Guy is spending the whole storyline looking for, he's heading towards her. She manages to get around him, go back to the guy that was in the room that Guy Gardner started in, and then kills him. You know, and it doesn't do anything to protect the guy. And the guy says, I just saved your life and I try to help you. And Guy Gardner literally strangles him up into the air, picks the guy up by his neck and is choking him, you know, and then the guy is stabbed to death panels later. You know, I mean, it's
what a great ending to his life.
It's the exact opposite of what
it was. A really bad day.
Let me tell you something else about this issue. Both of the covers, because it had two variant covers, one which is the for the story, and the other variant cover, have nothing to do with the story.
Yeah, because I think this was initially. Yeah, I think this was supposed to initially be a filler aftermath issue, and then this is what we got because they didn't have the end of the story ready yet. So, yeah, yeah. I mean, rather than delay it longer, they were just like, let's throw a fill in there. Why not? Why not? You know. I think, like I said, I can't even judge the story on its own merits. It's not really much of the story. It's Guy Gardner being, I'm going to take 3 months off, and then has to. Then he's promised 6 months off, and it's like that's like 7 years in comic book time. Like, there's no way.
We don't know. We don't know what happened at the end of war and the aftermath, because we have to assume that this is post aftermath.
Well, it's true. It's got to be. I mean, you know, it could take place, like Frankie said, at any point during the storylines. That's fine. I mean, I think everybody's kind of thinking Sinestro's going to get a ring and all kinds of shady business is going to happen at the end of war. So you think that Guy Gardner would not want to go on vacation then. But he's obviously a prick who leaves dudes who save his life to die in the middle of the spaceship, get stabbed to death. So also in this, there's a point in this issue where he's shooting down hallways at dudes, and it looks like he kills a couple of them. And then
– then there's another point where he –
he's just maiming
clearly
them.
Just – yeah.
Yeah, and then and it's kind of like, well, the old – I mean, I think – I don't know if I ever talked about this on the cast, but the old Guy Gardner, when Steve Englehart wrote him, when he first became the kind of like character that he's known for, used to murder people left and right, had no problem murdering people, allowed innocent people to get murdered, just, you know, because the Green Lantern Rings didn't have anything against killing until, I think, a specific way into the run. But, you know, he was murdering people left and right and stuff, so it was kind of weird to see like that come back, you know? I mean, there was a whole point of – there was a whole storyline where Guy Gardner and Kyle Rayner had a big fight over who was going to get to kill Major Force, and then Guy Gardner just did it at the end. He's like, I'm the kind of guy who likes to murder people. And then it's been this thing the last few years. Like, I remember the corpse storyline, and at
the,
some point
– the science sale incident.
Yeah, and then another incident where Guy Gardner actually does kill somebody, the two-headed guy, and then somebody says to him, hey, that's your first time using lethal force with the ring. And he's like, shut up, and flies away, and it's kind of like, I won't kill anybody. It's like, but you're the – that's you. You're the Green Lantern that thinks he's the Punisher. You're the Green Lantern that's a parody of every gun-toting nut. Like, you're the Green Lantern that kills people. That's your thing. So it was weird to see him shoot some dudes and then not shoot others, and you know. And the fact that – I know it's supposed to be the whole point of the issue is that he's so badass he doesn't need the ring and stuff. But, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm just – a little too old, but a guy running down a hallway with two gigantic guns shooting so accurately that he's able to pinpoint blow away guys' knees while flipping over two other dudes while landing on another dude. Where did he even get this training, one and two?
hey, man.
It's like no one could be that. I mean, if Batman could do it, that's fine, but no one could really do
it. If Batman could do it, fine, but that's Guy Gardner, hell no.
It's not like they both, you know, both had the same gym membership, you know, like, you know.
It's silly.
The GLA Towers, you know, both of them didn't have access to Wonder Woman to train.
Yeah, and it's not like
Hopefully I've never had a Kilowog, you know, there to have, you know, give him basic 101, you know, freaking gunslinging.
Yeah, and again, and you know, it's basically like, not for nothing, the guy that Guy Gardner, who saves Guy Gardner's life to stop this evil villain's plan, and is murdered subsequently by Guy Gardner for his trouble, he says everyone on the ship is a slave and they don't want to do what they're doing. So basically Guy Gardner runs through a ship. It's supposed to be impressive because he's being
I don't think he says that. I think he says I'm a slave.
Yeah, he said he was a slave. He says he can't quit.
Oh, you guys can talk amongst yourselves while I try to find the line of dialogue.
Maybe he's just been playing a lot of Duke Nukem lately.
He says, I can't leave because punishment for leaving is death.
Right, which I take to imply that, you know, anybody who tries to leave is going to be killed.
He's the only one of his race on that ship, so I assume
they're all wearing masks.
The only prince.
Oh, there's a lot of buzzing.
Point back is, I'm just saying, like, the whole point of the issue seems to be that Guy Gardner is such a badass that he can fight a whole ship of dudes by himself with no ring, and that's like, well, that's fine, I guess. I'm not really, I don't know, I guess I'm kind of over that, and it's not like these are, like, impressive dudes, it's just some regular, random-ass yellow dudes on a ship, and, you know, and the fact that the last page is, like, really rams home the quintessential Peter Tomasi dialogue. Read that as me saying horrific, horrific, horrific overwritten dialogue, you know, into characters' mouths.
But well, I sure as hell don't need a ring to take the likes of you downtown.
Guy Gardner apparently speaks very well and very fast at all times. I want my freaking ring back. I sure as hell don't need a ring to take the likes of you downtown. Like, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's just, you're saying too much stuff. You just don't need to say all that.
Well, at least
to the king, baby.
There were no Star Trek references, though, right? So it's okay.
No Star Trek references this time.
Can we at least talk about the constructs? Because I thought
that's cool.
This is the first time that we've seen Guy Gardner let loose with constructs, and at least since the even before Sinestro Corps War, because even then he wasn't doing anything impressive. Yeah.
You don't really see a lot of constructs, except he makes naked ladies all the time, I guess.
And motorcycles. Yeah.
Baseball bats.
Yeah.
Well, you're right. You're actively seeing constructs being used in a tactical sense, which you don't ever see in Green Lantern comics. So you're absolutely right about that. That struck me too when I first started reading. And it's kind of like a big thing where they wanted to show off Guy Gardner's constructs, and then they wanted to show off that he's a badass without the constructs. So I don't know. This story is not compelling at all to me. It's not really interesting.
I think a lot of that is Bernard Chang and his his pointy faces. And
I actually like his art.
Bernard Chang. He's a very good, he's a very talented artist. I do enjoy him in projects. Again,
something
this story
about
the
way he draws. Sometimes the way he draws Guy's costume actually makes me like Guy's costume a lot. Maybe because he draws it more fitted than some other people, but I just like the way Guy's – maybe it's just because of the way he draws Guy's head a little bigger and his hair and stuff.
Little knot in the back of his head. Yeah.
I kind of like the way his Guy Gardner looks, which seems really specific. But, you know, I like it. So that makes the collar look cooler.
Again, this story is a one-shot issue. It's technically, you know, it's supposed to take it with a grain of salt. This is a midpoint break during the War of the Green Lantern storyline where Guy Gardner's doing this thing, you know. And a lot of people, again, Eric, you weren't that big of a Guy Gardner fan to begin with.
Yeah.
If it's a story of a character that you enjoy, like many of the other Green Lantern fans out there enjoy Guy Gardner's stories, they'll get a kick out of it. You know, this guy doing this thing, running around in a spaceship, two guns a-blazing, not killing people, killing people. You know, it has everything for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, the point was to hold us over until July when we get the conclusion of the war. So, yeah, I mean,
Am I terribly pleased about that? No, I would have loved
You'd be a little more pissed if we didn't have anything to talk about.
No, I think it's fine, and I think if you're a Guy Gardner fan and you're a fan of the kind of the one-notedness that is Guy Gardner and the kind of limited fact that Guy Gardner's been taking this kind of one-note sadistic character and softened but still kind of keeps the same character. It juvenile. I mean, if you're into that, you probably got off on it. If you're the kind of character Guy Gardner's your favorite Lantern, you probably thought it was great. Guy Gardner's not my favorite Lantern. I like Guy Gardner in the Green Lantern Corps. I like him in Number Warriors because he's surrounded by other people and because he's a counterpoint to a conversation. You know, but if he's the only one in the conversation, it's not that interesting. And honestly, not for nothing, it looks like this might be proof that Peter Tomasi, I mean, obviously he made up this, I mean, I say obviously, but I'm assuming he made the story up kind of on the fly and wrote it really quick, and they threw it together because they knew the other one wasn't going to come out in time. So I think Under the Gun, it's not really in depth, and there's kind of unnecessary stuff, like there's really no reason for the bed to be electric just to be cute, and then I guess the fact that the character at the end, the main woman, is an imposter, I don't even get what that's why. Like, it's not like she turns out to be
a character. Yeah, because she says, I'm in it for the power. Well, you didn't need to be
You didn't need to be her to be, and you didn't need to not be her. Like, the fact that that's just like a way to waste a page so that Guy Gardner, the person that Guy Gardner, that saved Guy Gardner's life.
I guess she did it to
to take over that woman's family, like she said.
But even then, yeah. But, no, it's fine. Again, I understand the character makes it. Why in the comic?
Again, it's supposed to be intriguing. Again, one child issue, that's, it was supposed to have, like, yeah, these little tiny little, two little, like, tiny little threats and make it seem like there was a bigger picture involved rather than just be, you know, straightforward, romp into space, and Guy Gardner had to fight some dude who just wanted his ring.
Yeah, it gets about as straightforward as it gets, and throwing a little twist in there is supposed to make it more interesting, but I just read it and was like, oh, she's an imposter. This is going to turn out to be... And then she was just a shapeshifter. I'm like, well, so? Like, what does that add to the story at all? Just, it wastes a half... Again, it just said that the guy that Guy Gardner left to be murdered was murdered, you know? So, I don't really know what you want from me. You know? And what is the point of murdering that guy? That just was really depressing. I mean, it makes the bad guy more sadistic. I don't know. It's like...
It's a realistic job, you know? And you can't always save the day.
And then he didn't even try. And then
he did try. He took out like 30 guys.
In no way helping this guy. He specifically picks the guy up and says,
well, you know, he's like down the hallway. Guy had to get through like 30 other guys to get to that hallway. So, you know, he had to do
he's
something.
In a completely different part of the ship. He just leaves him where he is. The woman walks right up to him and kills him, and he doesn't even care.
He
doesn't even care. He didn't even try to help the guy. At least tell him to hide in the cargo bay because I'm going to fuck shit up right here. Like, I know they're going to know that you saved me and, like, you know. But the guy basically spends the entire issue begging for his life because he doesn't want to die, and he doesn't want this woman to conquer the universe. And Guy Gardner's like, "Fuck you, be murdered. Do that instead."
That is be murdered.
All right. We're gonna move on from that one.
What a great episode.
Shade.
This is ridiculous.
Be sure to check us out at www.thegreenlanterncorps.com.
You can also email us at contact@thegreenlanterncorps.com.
You can follow us on Twitter at @theGLCorps.
And be sure to check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/GLSpotlight.
You can reach our voicemail line at 313-GL1-2814. That's 313-451-2814.
Thanks for listening, and check us out next time, and please stop masturbating when I'm talking to you.
Don't forget to check out Kirby Crackle, the performance of our opening theme, Ring Capacity, at kirbycracklemusic.com. Also check out the Roy Clark Method, the performance of our ending theme, Sector 2814, at freeweb.com/RoyClarkMethod.
This magic green, it is the color green, it can do anything, sometimes it speaks to me, it says how.